what's the name of it? What's the name of it? Like to let everyone know that you're listening to this being recorded.
All right, that kind of goes into something else I wanted to ask you. Like, what is your day like?
So on a day-to-day level, it can have a huge amount of variance. We kind of wear a lot of different hats. At some level, being a distiller or a brewer or a winemaker, if you're really good at what you do, I'll argue with anyone about this, but it's glorified janitorial work. Because ultimately we spend a lot of time, trying to source ingredients, botanicals and things like that, and fruit, and all of that work a lot of this stuff comes down to having every opportunity to screw something up. And if you manage not to screw it up, then the best job that I have is to act as a caretaker for those raw ingredients, and to sort of escort them through a process so that the best version of themselves, those pears at their peak of ripeness, or this juniper in a gin, genuinely shows the nuance and terroir of where it came from and what it is in that expression. But on a day-to-day basis, I've got a couple of guys that work on the floor. So in terms of making sure everything's running, trying to make sure that we kind of run relatively efficiently. Fortunately, just being a very mentioned earlier that we're sort of driven by creativity. We spend a lot of time on. I tell most folks that there's the right way to do something, the wrong way to do something, and then the St. George way to do something, which means we spend lots of time on projects that really have no fiscal value for the company. With that said, it helps to deepen our understanding and to learn more and to be more expressive. Lance has got a great quote about, you can't dance like Jennifer Beals, and you can't write poetry like Neruda, but we can distill here. That's the goal.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like experimentation, right? Or like.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got a lab set up. We've got a couple of small stills. Affectionately, we've named them Waldorf and Statler, after the old Muppets that were in the balcony.
Nice.
Make fun of all the other Muppets. it's a 10-liter still and a 30-liter still. Some of my favorite days are days when I'm working in the lab and just trying to see what I can figure out. One of the projects I have going right now, there's a liqueur called Chartreuse.
Okay.
Sort of digestive. Rich history, arguably about 120 botanicals. It's kind of like a formula of Coke. No one person knows the whole formula for this thing, as the story goes. It's three different monks who always possess pieces of the formula and put it all together, but no one person actually has the entire formula. But it's this wonderful, wonderful, herbaceous, piney sort of a liqueur, and so I've been trying to work that I'd call that sort of like my white whale project. I've been playing around with that idea for the last 5 years. And this year I brought in I had a Douglas fir for a Christmas tree. So I brought it into St. George. I chopped it all up, soaked it in apple brandy, and then I've been working with that and working that as a basis for my chartreuse projects for the coming year. And next year I fully expect to do my Christmas tree again, and I'll try to keep adjusting, and in about 25 years I suspect I'll have something that's passable and interesting.
That's crazy. Like your actual Christmas tree, you brought it in?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a couple years back, Lance brought in his Christmas tree before Absinthe was legal. We were doing some test batches here for research and development purposes, if I could say that legally. And he brought in his Christmas tree, and we made a Christmas tree Absinthe.
Wow.
So that was you involve that. So done noble furs. I mean, we'll try anything once. It's a stupid idea. I'll try it four or five times just to make sure. So I've got we've tried different Christmas trees. We've distilled foie gras. We made crab brandy.
What? Are you serious?
I'm playing around with an oyster gin right now, actually distilling oysters and using that as part of a gin that's really inspired and influenced by the idea of a mignonette sauce. So cucumber and fennel seed and lemon. Some cilantro, parsley. And so we went through, like in the foie gras thing, we went through goose, went through duck, we did vodka bases, we did brandy bases, we did fat washing, we did seared, we did raw. We tried all kinds of stuff.
Is that like the first sort of animal-based alcohol known to man, or what?
As far as I know, yeah. I mean, if anyone else has done something like that, I definitely don't know about it. It's a for a lot of stuff that I think inspires us here. It's very often, though, most of our work comes from being inspired by sort of produce in the local culinary scene. It's usually, I mean, Lance and York created a Hanger One vodka a few years back, and we've since sold that brand off to another company. And we still make it for the company, but we don't actually own it anymore. But that thing literally came from Lance used to walk to his apartment over in Oakland, and he would walk to the laundromat, and he kept going by this mandarin blossom, this mandarin tree, like his mandarin blossom. So he stole fresh mandarin blossoms from a neighbor, basically. The Captor Lime Vodka came from a love for Thai food, and usually we're kind of love to eat something. And the next question is, I wonder if I can make this with alcohol.
Wow.
And so, I mean, ultimately, it always kind of comes back to a question for us of alcohol as a carrier pigeon for all of our other work we do.
Mm-hmm.
This is about esters and essential oils and flavors and aromatics. And if we can stabilize that and make it soluble in alcohol, take a sensory snapshot of this thing that we love in real life
by
using alcohol as a medium, that's what brings us into work every day.
Yeah.
But I mean, ultimately, I end up doing a lot of sourcing for produce and botanicals.
When you say sourcing, is that like, do you like, research where to find bulk loads of it? Or are you just looking for like one, like smell or something?
It depends on what we're working with. Like trying to hunt down juniper, like Douglas fir. We use Douglas fir and a terroir gin. The terroir gin we make is inspired by Mount Tam, which is up in Marin County. That involves working with a local forager, learning about some of the local botanicals up on Mount Tam, because Lance knew he wanted to make something that was of that place, but we wanted to really help to better identify how to wild forage the stuff. And so some of it's stuff where I'm ordering things. One of the things I use is the Saigon cinnamon in the terroir gin, and I can't get cinnamon locally in California. And if I could, it would be awful. And so, this is a Saigon cinnamon. This is all, I can get this stuff from Southeast Asia. But on the flip side of that, something like Douglas fir is an invasive species to the Bay Area. It doesn't actually come from here. And what we were able to find and learn about it is if we harvest at a certain time of year, we can wild forage. We can harvest actually about right about now, this time of year. And in doing that, it's much easier on the trees if we're taking branches, because the sap's not going to bleed out so heavily. We capture that stuff. So we go and we'd wild forage, and for a while we were wild foraging up on Mount Tam in a really responsible way. We were trying to get the low-hanging branches and saplings that were too close to older trees. And ultimately, it was through sourcing ingredients for an apple brandy project we've been working on for the last 2 years. I was working with a grower up in Mendocino County, so a bit north of here in the Bay Area, and talking about having to forage on Mount Tam for Douglas fir. And he said, my neighbor's got hundreds of acres, and he's got Douglas fir, and this is the time of year that he's actually chopping some of the low-hanging branches and the saplings down and burning all of that, just because it's a fire hazard for these trees, which is what we were kind of doing anyway, and what we had sort of learned in our own work. So I got on the phone with this guy and started talking to the to the neighbor about this stuff, and I've got a great relationship now where I can wild forage Doug fir within about 100 miles of Mount Tam, and do it in a very still responsible manner. And it's something where we're just I can get up there on the same day that he's chopping the stuff down, so I can get it fresh, bring it back to the shop here. We'll infuse it, so soak it in like 190 proof alcohol, and then we'll eventually distill it and create a spirit of that tree that we can then blend in to that terroir gin. So it's a, everything's a little piecemeal. There's different processes, different things you're trying to juggle between sort of all facets of production. And all these projects are probably, and then on the flip side of that, we've got our own single malt whiskey that we've been making for the last 16 years. So we work with really close with Sierra Nevada, and they brew us a beer that's our recipe. They ship it down to us. We ferment that, we distill it, we age it here, and then we hand select our own barrels. So that single malt whiskey is stored in like used bourbon barrels and used sherry casks, port casks, full barrels, and then we'll actually create a blend for the year, maybe 15 barrels.
So wait, how does that work again? Like, it's Sierra Nevada makes you a beer?
Yeah, they make us a beer that's our recipe.
Okay.
So we sent. So those guys are great alcoholics and good friends.
Okay.
And so we distill the beer into a white dog, and then we age that in our barrels, and then sort of monitor our barrels and taste through them every year and see where we're at. And so a lot of my responsibility falls into I spend a lot of time with our barrels. Taste through every one of our barrels every year. Have another tasting partner that I work with, and we spend a lot of time trying to create sort of a sensory library of every barrel and where it's at and what it smells like and what it tastes like. And if it's a barrel that my best job is to leave it alone because it's beautiful on its own, it's a complete picture. And there's sometimes you find barrels that are very incomplete pictures, but it's a really beautiful, vibrant color that we can paint with when we're trying to blend something.
Yeah.
So we'll choose barrels, or maybe a barrel needs to be moved over to a different barrel. Like, you know, this is a single malt whiskey that's in a bourbon barrel, but it's actually, I think it's kind of grassy and it's kind of funky because every barrel is very unique to itself. It has different flavors and aromatics. And so maybe we need to finish this whiskey in a rum barrel or something like that.
Right. Damn. So here's another question that I've kind of been wondering. Do you have like this incredible palate? Like, did you discover that you had a good palate, or did it just develop?
My mom always said I was a picky eater, so
okay.
No, I quite honestly I don't think that I have any sort of incredible palate. I spend a lot of time doing this. I spent a lot of time working very hard to better understand these things, and I put a lot of stock in sort of, we have a unique process we've developed here for tasting, where we always try to taste with a partner.
Right.
So you taste and you start to learn about each other's palates. And as you're tasting something that I think is really hard for people, and at least was very hard for me, most of the time when we taste, we don't necessarily taste with the same people. And you don't try to sort of create the same circumstances. You don't taste in the same room, the same type of glassware. What did you have for lunch that day? Like, all of these things are absolute factors. There's stories about Japanese whiskey blenders who will have the same bowl of soba noodles every day at the same time, and then they will go and taste their whiskey set every day at the same time. And like that stuff, you know, you're trying to like basically cut away those variables.
Right.
And have a really strong perspective on your own palate, what you're tasting, why you're tasting that, is completely necessary. And ultimately, what I would say though, is that I've sort of spent a lot of time tasting and being thoughtful about what I smell and what I taste.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think it's necessarily a palate thing at all. So much as that experience level that builds up and sort of those sensory connections. So that you can start to taste things and almost it's a little bit to like a synesthesia kind of place where you're saying like, you're trying to narrow something down, but it's kind of like, this tastes blue to me. Why does it taste blue? It sort of has this cooling sensation. Is there menthol? So is that menthol maybe more like, is that sage? Is that mint? Is that spearmint? If it's mint, is it spearmint or peppermint or chocolate peppermint or... Like, you kind of have these tracks that you go down.
Right.
But, yeah, in that sense, I feel really strongly about the work that we do because we spend a huge amount of time tasting these barrels and really trying to carefully understand what we have and how to best sort of help these barrels as individuals.
At the end of a tasting day, are you just wasted or are you spitting it out?
We don't spit out in the, at least for us. Some folks in the spirits world do spit out still, but I feel really strongly that usually some of the best things about a spirit is that breathe out. It's after you've sipped it and you're breathing
right.
it out.
Yeah.
It would taste like 5 seconds later, 10 seconds, 30 seconds later. If I'm wasted, then I'm not doing my job. I'm not being thoughtful. And so you can definitely have palate fatigue and you can only kind of do so much. But you know, you're drinking lots of water, you're eating lots of crackers,
right.
Definitely, you know, occasionally taking naps. So
that's fun.
But yeah, it's definitely, you know, you want to be thoughtful and trying to do right by these barrels and, your job. And there's, yeah, it's what it comes down to. We got another project where I go out to Kentucky and buy, individual barrels of bourbon from other distilleries.
Okay.
bring those back to our house, and then we make a blend of bourbon called Break In Entering.
Yeah.
And that's every one of them is about 80 barrels.
I've heard of that.
And selected barrels.
Yeah.
So we're doing that thing as well, and that's something where we want to be really clear because we're proud of being distillers here at St. George. We've been this is a distillery for the last 31 years. We're an independently owned craft American distillery for the last 31 years. When Jorg, our founder, when he started this company, it was like 1982. Like,
wow.
He's out there trying to sell, you know, German schnapps, air brandy, to an American public where Coors is still a regional brand name, and there's a little company called B&J Gallo that offered you a Chablis.
Yeah.
It's a white or red. Which one do you want?
Yeah, yeah.
And we're really, really proud of that, obviously. So the Breaking and Entering Project was something where we thought we had something to contribute to the bourbon category as blenders to sort of make a bourbon that's greater than the sum of its parts by blending barrels from different distilleries. But to really be careful in our selection, how we chose each of those barrels was sort of our value to this. And we had called the Breaking and Entering because we wanted everyone to believe that we had ninja-like stealth and precision, and we didn't want to confuse anyone with a sense of, we've made this ourselves. We haven't made that particular bourbon ourselves.
Right.
We are purchasing it from other folks.
Yeah.
We just want to be really direct and honest about that because there's a lot of marketing and bullshit in this industry.
Yeah, I was actually wondering that because I saw that you made bourbon and I was like, doesn't that have to be made in Kentucky, right?
It doesn't actually have to be made in Kentucky.
Oh, no?
Yeah, it doesn't actually have to be made in Kentucky. It's got to be made in America and has to be aged for no fewer than 2 years. And brand new charred American oak.
Oh, okay.
It has to be at least 51% corn, but no more than 79% corn. There's some laws around it, but it doesn't have to be made in Kentucky anymore.
Oh, that's cool.
I'm not sure when if that's just sort of like an old tale or if it actually changed at some point, but it hasn't been that way in a while. So there's a lot of folks who make bourbon. I'd say one of the largest bourbon producers in the world, in America, is actually in Indiana.
Well, no shit.
Yeah. Wow. And they make decent juice. I mean, it's some bourbon coming out of there, but it's a lot of, unfortunately, you can look on a lot of shelves and you'll see a couple of different bourbons lined up right next to each other with different labels on it from different companies.
Uh-huh.
Everyone's talking about their little distillery and it's kind of like, nope, that one came from Indiana and that one came from the exact same place in Indiana and that one came from the same place in Indiana.
Yeah.
So it's always a little disheartening to see that.
So you were talking about naming, Breaking and Entering though. That's gotta be fun to name a new product.
Yeah, you know, that's the kind of stuff that Breaking and Entering came was my boss Lance. He named that one. Sort of as an inside joke with his wife Allie, who's our director of communications. And it was it's definitely kind of part of the we sort of have a sense here that those who make what's inside of a bottle, those who are part of that creative experience. Are arguably the best armed and the best, most understanding of how to paint the invitation to what's on the inside of that bottle. And so we do work with graphic artists. We get a lot of help from friends, but that art direction, like in the Breaking and Entering label, that came from my boss Lance. And who did that? My friend Brandon Josie, actually. So Brandon's used to be a bartender in the city.
Uh-huh.
And, we talked to Brandon. He said, yeah, you know, he was a graphic designer by training, but was a bartender in the city, a really successful guy. And he's actually up in Portland now, working at a great bar. But Brandon was kind of trying to, you know, do some graphic design on the side and really, you know, kind of miss that part of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, you know, yeah, let's, you know, think you can do this. You know, and Lance sent Brandon some pictures and told him a little bit about what we wanted to see. And and Brandon, I think, he got off shift at about 3:30 in the morning, had an email out to us by like 6:30 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And it was like 90% there. Like the thing that Lance had seen, you know, and occasionally, and that you start to talk about like in graphic design and trying to work with someone, a lot, I've had too many experiences where I've seen a graphic designer and you're like redoing this idea and redoing this idea and they just don't, you're trying to like hone it in, but you guys just don't, you clearly don't see the same thing.
Right.
And then occasionally you work with someone and they're kind of like, you describe this thing out to them and they get it almost completely right. Like they saw the exact same thing. They saw your influences and what through, you choose that image and that style.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, this is what you mean. This is what I would do. And it's like, oh,
yeah.
I mean, like that's about as close as I think as you get to telekinesis at some level.
Right,
like,
right.
Actually, they saw and appreciated what you appreciated.
Hey, so what's your favorite thing that you what's your favorite thing that you make there?
I can't choose between the children like that.
Yeah. Oh, I guess that's right. That's a mean question.
So what I can tell you is one of the things I'm really excited about, though, is we're working on some Apple Randy. We've been doing custom sealed blends of apples up in Mendocino, bringing them back down here. We're selling this Apple Brandy or putting it in the barrel. There's a wonderful restaurant called 11 Madison Park in New York. Just got the James Beard Award this year for best restaurant in the world.
Wow.
These guys are, I think was in the world, it's at least North America. I think they got the world. But they do an unaged version. They have a sort of a custom project with them where they do an unaged version of this apple brandy.
Wow.
And it's beautiful. I couldn't be more excited about this project and sort of where this is all going. And so I'm hoping that if I stop sipping off the barrels, that there'll actually be some left to sell in a couple years.
Hey, here's another question I had. Like, like you were talking about like the business end of it. Are you guys, like, what's in the future for you guys? Like, would you get really big, or do you want to stay like this small company?
How to best describe that?
It's kind of a weird question.
No, I also understand. I definitely understand it. I once asked my boss Lance that same question just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And one of the best things I can describe here is that to try to explain something, we have the St. George Spirits, where this company, we're going on 31 years now. We're very small.
Mm-hmm.
We had a product that we created that Lance and Yor created called Hangar One Vodka.
Yeah.
And Hangar One Vodka did very well. The timing was right. I think the product is outstanding. And these guys, we really saw something special here.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be making these eau de vie, these unaged fruit brandies for years and years, and for years sold more to Europe than they ever sold in the States. And what it came down to is that Americans don't speak eau de vie. We don't speak unaged fruit brandy. We don't have that. We don't sip on that after dinner.
Yeah.
But what Lance and New York started to discover is that using some of those same techniques and that same appreciation for those raw ingredients and using that to create a vodka, their first basis for creating a vodka was that they don't like vodka, and said, what would make you like vodka? Well, what if you get vodka, but it's legally vodka, but what if we did this and this and this for, And they came from a place of not liking what was out there and to try to create something for themselves. And ultimately, that's what we always come back to here, is to make, we make something for ourselves. And if other people like it, we're very grateful. And we want to make enough to share. And if other people don't like it,
right.
So like, we make it for ourselves, and we'll drink it on poker night if no one wants to buy it.
Yeah.
And they started to create this vodka, and what they discovered by that, though, and we'll heard what that's really about, is that Americans don't speak O to B, but we do speak vodka.
Right.
And they could have the same message and story of what they were doing with those O to B's in vodka as a category. And Americans understood that. All of a sudden, that was very different. They saw some growth there. It's responsible for me getting a job at St. George Spirits is the growth of that vodka, and then needing someone else at that point.
Yeah.
And got so big that we were in all 50 states. We had minor international sales.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit to Southeast Asia, a little bit to Europe. And this is a really, really competitive industry. And we were sort of faced with a choice that we either needed to reorganize our company
mm-hmm.
into a company that manages distribution and marketing and okay. really invest heavily in doing that so that this product could be competitive or for its growth.
Mm-hmm.
Or, and be quite honest with you, that is the worst goddamn part of this entire industry.
I totally know what you mean, man.
That is not the reason that I come to work, man. That's what we like to do here. We like to make shit up. We like to create spirits.
Yeah.
And so the best opportunity that vodka had was to sell it to another company. and another company that is designed to manage distribution and marketing. And it was this sort of sad but, you know, necessary parting of the ways at some level, even that we still make this product for them, but it's a sort of just a custom project for another company now.
Uh-huh.
Because it was kind of like this fly, make mama proud kind of moment, you know? You know, it could kind of go away. Because honestly, we like to create things. And since we've sold Hangar One Vodka, St. George Spirits has had the resources to create three new gins from scratch. We've also done two, actually four custom gins for some friends and small groups and small projects.
Mm-hmm.
We had it gave us the resources to literally fly out to Kentucky and go hand select individual barrels. At this point, we purchased about 500 individual barrels from Kentucky.
Wow. Yeah.
Of bourbon for our break-in and entering project.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of applying those resources and doing more different things that's allowed us to sort of move on and change a little bit. You know, it's been really exciting. When I first started here, St. George Spirits, no one knew what it was actually what this company was, but they knew Hangar One Vodka, and it was always, oh, you're those guys who make Hangar One Vodka.
Right. Okay.
Now, when people call in, when people come out here to visit our tasting room,
mm-hmm.
people talk to us about our whiskey. People talk to us about our gin. Oh my God, you guys made those gins. Like, it's been kind of amazing to see that growth and transition, and I'll be interested to see, you know, where it goes from here.
That's awesome.
Continue to evolve and change.
Yeah, that's awesome that you guys like had to make that choice. Like, do we do something that we don't like, or do we sell it off so we can keep doing something that we do like doing?
That's and I mean, hell, man, I have the sense that I think you kind of understand this from your own experience and your help from creating this magazine.
Yeah.
The key here is to make something for yourself.
Right.
This is what I would want to have for myself. And that's, I think at some intrinsic level, that is a really direct appeal and communication to people about, people recognize things that are made genuinely.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, people don't, you know, if they don't like it, that's fine, but they still appreciate something that's got that genuine, that's been created genuinely. I have a friend who's an architect, and he talks about the process of creating a building and that you have all these people working on it. And that you cannot, you know, a committee is incapable of designing a stallion. It doesn't work that way. As soon as, you know, you're trying to design a horse, and as soon as the committee becomes involved in it, because you have to sort of cut so many corners to make everyone happy, you always design a jackass. It's always lesser. Any sort of writer or artist, how many writers have you read interviews by? They talk about writing for their perfect audience member.
Yeah.
It's their wife or their mistress or whatever it is, but it's always you're really right for one person.
Mm-hmm.
You don't write for everyone. That's the only way that you can get this thing out of you.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the same. That's the necessity of the process for us.
This is so brilliant, dude. Like, this is great. Like, I was actually thinking as you said, as you were telling that story, I was like, I'm so glad this is being recorded so I can go and listen to that and like re-listen to it and apply it to like what I'm going through with Bull, you know, right now. But man,
oh, nice, man. That's really kind of you, and I appreciate it. This is what we do. This is why we do it. I don't think I have words to describe how fortunate I feel to be in a place where I tell most folks this, but. It's great. You know, I get to enjoy a creative life, and the people I work with, I'll fight with them like roommates, but I love them like family.
Yeah.
This is kind of a pretty special thing. If you're kind of, you're, it sounds like you're kind of starting to develop that now, you know, you just gotta make it for yourself and stay on that.
Yeah. And you guys are killing it now, aren't you? The reviews are like awesome. Like, you get all these blurbs from like these major media outlets.
Yeah, we're doing really well. Ellie, Lance's wife, is totally wonderful. She's really come on board here. She's taken a lot of responsibility for following up on and really making sure that we have ways to communicate and taking over our Twitter and Facebook and making sure that we're up to date as we're doing things. We're kind of out there. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of it just kind of happens naturally. But it's amazing to sort of see that family effort. Everyone's leaning into the wind and is part of the same ship.
Dude, that is so cool. All right, well, you've been too kind to me.
Yeah, Jared, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it, and hope to talk to you soon, okay?
You too, bro.
All right, man. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Bye.